Добрий день, це подкаст «Коли все має значення».
Привіт, мене звати Ангеліна Карякіна.
А мене Наталя Гуменюк.
І сьогодні ми говоримо про гостя особливого, який давно живе в Україні і давно займається міжнародним правом. Але нас розмова з ним цікавила з такої, можливо, трошки незвичної перспективи. Це Вейн Джордаш.
Це британський юрист, один з найкращих юристів-міжнародників у сфері воєнних злочинів і всього того, що стосується міжнародного гуманітарного права. Вейн приїхав після окупації Криму сюди, щоб займатися цими справами і Донбасом, залишився в Україні, одружився, має тут родину, це його рідна країна сьогодні. Після повномасштабного вторгнення, звісно, він повністю ще більше включився в документування воєнних злочинів. Він є очільником юридичної компанії Global Rights Compliance, але це також і фонд, який працює з українською прокуратурою і радить, як правильно документувати воєнні злочини.
Його досвід, безумовно, це досвід практикуючого юриста. Що особливо цікавим є в його біографії для тебе? Для
Вейн працював на судах на Балканах, в Сєра-Леоне, в Камбоджі, але в судах він був адвокатом захисту, тобто він захищав воєнних злочинців. І в Україні він, по суті, вперше в такому масштабі на стороні жертв.
Це означає, що він дуже добре розуміє, яка має бути тактика обвинувачення для того, аби вона в суді спрацювала. Ну, так мені принаймні видається.
Про це я й запитала, як і запитала про те, чи захищав би сьогодні Вейн лідерів російської держави, зокрема Путіна. Відповідь буде пізніше, як і пояснення, чому він робив саме це і був адвокатом захисту. Я особливо в березні 22-го року дуже багато з ним спілкувалася, коли все починалося, і було дуже багато запитань. І він дійсно завжди наполягає на тому, що адвокат захисту вчинить так, адвокат захисту поставить це під сумнів. І, здається, це доволі хороша позиція, з якої можна будувати доказову базу, щоб таких речей не трапилося.
Чим саме зараз займається його фонд в Україні? Ти кажеш, він співпрацює з Генеральною прокуратурою. Що саме він робить?
До великого вторгнення вони буквально розповідали і вчили прокурорів, зокрема Кримської прокуратури, наприклад, як правильно збирати докази воєнних злочинів. Тому що в Україні нема такої школи. Мені керівник Кримської прокуратури вже сказав, що навіть в найкращому виші, де вчаться юристи українські, міжнародному гуманітарному праву приділяли дуже мало уваги. Тому спочатку це було таке навчання, практики, але після великого вторгнення, і, зокрема, останній рік найбільше, вони, власне, допомагають прокуратурі переключитися на оце розуміння того, а чим відрізняється розслідування воєнних злочинів від кримінальних злочинів, де прогалини, на що треба звертати увагу. Це також і виявлення патернів, і те, як взагалі розслідувати це? В нас дуже багато злочинів розслідуються як окремі випадки. Тобто один постраждалий, один злочин, один постраждалий, один злочин. І, чесно кажучи, треба мозок, думки, щоб пояснити, що там, не знаю, всю Херсонщину можна сприймати як велику катівню. Да, як перелаштувати і зробити з окремих індивідуальних історій і випадків, як у випадках з окремими вбивствами і трагічними історіями, як вийти на загальну картину. Але я просто дуже добре пам'ятаю, коли я приїхала з Бучі, і на наступний день Вейн приїхав з Бучі, коли вона тільки відкрилася. Він пояснював тоді мені, що робить звичайний прокурор, коли приїжджає на місце злочину. Він бачить вбитих і думає, що цього достатньо. Зафіксована ця річ. Наприклад, якщо в Бородянці будівля розбита і розтрощена, для прокурора, який має зафіксувати воєнні злочини, критично не прибрати докази, а довести, що там люди просто спали, там не було військових. Вони, наприклад, вбрані в піжами, в нічні сорочки, і це були звичайні люди. Якщо цього пункту не зафіксувати, то насправді сам факт вбивства людей може не бути доведено як воєнний злочин. Це пояснення мені тоді дуже багато чого допомогло потім розуміти самій, так би працюючи з темою вже як журналістка, де оця різниця? І от саме такі речі, їх дуже багато по ходу, коли йдеться там про катування, окупацію, на них вони і вказують.
Я пам'ятаю, коли ми починали роботу проєкту, і Вейн говорив з учасниками, з учасницями, він стримував, так би мовити, наші надії, наш оптимізм стосовно нашої роботи, і доволі скептично дивився на те, якого успіху, так би мовити, з точки зору справедливості, ми можемо досягти в судах. Тобто в нього доволі такий реалістичний, скептичний погляд на те, як працює міжнародне право стосовно воєнних злочинів. Скажімо, як він реально оцінює наші шанси в судах? Що може таки потрапити в суд, і хто може отримати вирок?
Це якраз велика тема, ми про це, напевно, найбільше й говорили. Мій був запит пояснити, де є оцей реалістичний скепсис. Що відбувається? Журналісти дуже очікують, що юристи зроблять свою справу, а коли ти починаєш дискутувати з юристами, вони кажуть: «Ей, не сподівайтеся, пишіть свої статті», і ти в такому ступорі. Я запитувала, зокрема, про те, де ми не маємо зовсім бути зневіреними. І, звісно, це якась невеличка частина злочинів. Всі не будуть покарані, але там і він наполягає, чому критично довести, що це якби масштабна справа, да, що відповідальні не просто окремі солдати чи окремі генерали, які, можливо, от так вийшло, що вони за, як то кажуть, штатним розписом та от вписані там в цю систему російської армії, а можливо відповідальний більше той чи інший. Але, зокрема, і говорити про якісь інші види справедливості і розуміти цю реалістичність. Вейн сьогодні, попри те, що він звучатиме, можливо, десь не так оптимістично, як хотілося би українцям, все одно звучить набагато оптимістичніше, ніж коли ми там говорили 2 роки тому, коли не було такої кількості доказів, не було таких процесів, не було, можливо, політичної волі.
І він бачить роботу прокуратури зсередини.
Так, і говорить про те, що речі відбуваються. Це ніколи не буде ідеальним, але зупинятися точно не треба.
Останнє питання на затравку. Його робота як захисника, наскільки вона була успішною? Чи зміг він захистити підзахисних, вивести їх з-під суду? Напевно, це питання реалістичності цих звинувачень. Але все ж таки, чи ви говорили?
Це буде, чесно кажучи, спойлер. В основному він захищав людей, які були воєнними злочинцями, але їх звинувачували дещо в іншому. І, чесно кажучи, інколи це таки були цапи від бувайли. Ті, кого могли зловити, щоб хоча б когось засудити. Частково він був успішний в цьому, щоб довести, що ця людина конкретно за це не відповідала. І хочуть вказати і перекласти відповідальність на іншу людину, яка, можливо, цю відповідальність не має нести, а велику рибу не зловили.
Окей, тоді годі спойлерити. Слухаємо розмову Наталки Гуменюк з Вейном Джордашем.
Wayne, great to finally talk to you in this podcast.
Good to be talking to you.
We do have a lot to cover, but I really want really to start maybe even with some general ideas after the full-scale invasion. Right away, you came to Bucha, we were just opening these horrible scenes of the war crimes in Ukraine. It was already clear that it was horrible. But you were also speaking that war crime documentation takes a lot of time and effort. There should be very thorough process, diligent process of collecting the evidence. It's not so easy to prove it, especially war crimes. But quite soon, we were already thinking that overall we can reasonably speak about the fact that there are war crimes and even crimes against humanity. So, this cautious from the first days of the war very fast turned to the idea that actually it's not something we don't know. The war crimes are happening at this stage. How would you describe what Russia does in Ukraine?
You point to the difference between patterns and proof beyond reasonable doubt. And I think what's clear here is that there are clear patterns of war crimes and clear patterns of crimes against humanity. I'd actually go further than that. I'd say that the patterns give rise to a fairly powerful inference, which could be established beyond a reasonable doubt that these crimes have occurred. But the big question, of course, in a trial is who did it? Who's responsible? That has always been a difficult part of international criminal law. Trying to establish who the perpetrator was on the ground is difficult often, but I think more difficult is proving whether the organizers, the people at the top, the Putins of this world, should be held responsible for a particular pattern of criminality on the ground. Beyond a reasonable doubt requires, therefore, not just studying what happened on the ground, but studying the organization that was responsible for it and the political direction which may or may not have led to that particular organization acting in a particular way, which then led to individuals within that organization committing the actual act. So you are really talking about establishing a lot of links if you're trying to establish Putin's responsible, which I know is hard for people to sometimes accept because it seems obvious. There's patterns on the ground and there's Putin issuing his comments, which sound very much like he approves of what happens on the ground. But in any courtroom, a defense lawyer is going to do what he or she can to establish that he may have made these belligerent comments and he may or may not have had this particular authority, but it doesn't mean to say he's responsible for what happened in Bucha or Irpin. I'm very confident war crimes and crimes against humanity have occurred. I'm very confident that much of the Russian upper military and political elite, including Putin, are responsible. But give me the case in a courtroom, and it's going to take me a long time to prove it. What surprised me, I think, in Ukraine, to a certain extent, is that I meet a lot of people who think it's easy in civil society, but also in the prosecution. I think I'm the one person I hear constantly saying how difficult it is. Taking a good witness statement is difficult. Taking a witness statement which will not just record the facts, but which will protect the witness in the courtroom. Recording what the crater means. Recording, working out what proportionality means. And finally, putting all that together and working out what that means for criminal intent of an individual thousands of kilometers away. I think if they underestimate it, I think therein lies quite a problem. And I see that far too much in Ukraine, to be honest.
I remember well, especially during the first year of the war, when we were writing the articles within the Reckoning Project, you know, I was writing these like alleged war crimes in Ukraine, and there would be the Western editors asking, you know, can we prove that there are war crimes? At this stage, somehow it's already not in the legal way, but beyond the reasonable doubt that people stop to challenge the idea that they are happening. So how would you still describe, if you would speak for somebody, what's going on in Ukraine, you know, in this framework? And then we will go on the way how to prove them. Mm-hmm.
Just to be clear on the proving point, I think it's important to be clear about this distinction. In any international criminal trial or trial of international crimes, there is rarely much time spent proving the crimes occurred. The real question is always, is that individual responsible for them? And that's important because I think we can for sure, in my view, say beyond a reasonable doubt, the Russian military is responsible for an array of war crimes and an array of crimes against humanity. Why am I confident about that? It's going back to what I said about patterns, because the patterns keep repeating and repeating and repeating, and the patterns of criminal behavior like that, whether that's the creation of detention centers where arbitrary detention takes place, the torture within those detention centers, which is clearly happening, the destruction of civilian infrastructure with no apparent link to the military, the deliberate deportation of children and the deliberate deportation and forcible transfer of civilians. At some point, there becomes such a mass of information that there's no plausible explanation for it. I think also it's important to distinguish different types of war crimes in this regard, because let's say I, as an investigator, I see a man handcuffed or bound and shot in the head. There's no plausible explanation for it. It has to be a war crime. It doesn't matter whether he's a civilian or a soldier. That should never happen. And if it does, it violates international humanitarian law in a very serious way. So you don't need to examine that for very long. Other crimes, of course, are a bit trickier. House destroyed. You have to examine what the missile was, whether there was a military target nearby, whether this was an accident. So there are plausible defenses which take a bit more time to examine. But I would say in relation to all these types of crimes in Ukraine, whether the more easy analysis or where there's no plausible defense, all the way to those where there is a plausible defense, I think you can be pretty sure that these are happening. And those, where there's a plausible defense, it keeps occurring, it keeps occurring, it keeps occurring, and eventually excludes the plausible defense. Accidents don't happen repeatedly without intent.
On the investigation, 2 years, almost 2 years after, where do you think we are as the state, and where are still the things which should be really improved, first of all? Maybe it's the time to say that, you know, you came to Ukraine way earlier investigating the crimes that happened after the Russian annexation of Crimea, and you're working with, you know, consulting the local prosecutors. But, you know, we are not in 2022. We're 2024. It's already 2 years. What is now the big challenge?
Let me go back just briefly to 2015, 2016. The big challenge there was probably three big challenges. One was no access to the territory where the crimes occurred. The second was a lack of resources, so not enough prosecutors and investigators allocated to the job. And the third was just a lack of commitment on behalf of the Office of the Prosecutor. There was no real systematic effort to investigate the crimes, as far as I could see. Now, in 2022, what changed? Number one, access to the territory. Number two, investment of resources into prosecutors and investigators in terms of training. And number three, and most importantly, was commitment. I rarely meet a prosecutor these days who is not committed to actually finding out who did the crime or investigating the crime. There's still a question of capability. For me, working in Ukraine, trying to support the prosecution is a learning experience every day. And I've been doing this for 20 years. You cannot just simply in 2 years, in 3 years or 4 years, develop all the skills necessary to investigate these crimes. And secondly, it requires a multidisciplinary approach. So you're never going to learn all the skills that these investigations require. I need a team of people around me who've had a variety of experiences. You know, you need commitment, you need a multidisciplinary team, and you need a fast learning experience. You need to be committed to learning. Again, that goes back to what I said about people thinking it's easy. That worries me, because it makes me think that people think that they don't have anything to learn. If I'm learning every day at 20 years experience, and I think most people in Ukraine who've not had the experience probably need to do the same.
Maybe in a way that it's okay for you, you can really describe what exactly you're doing now in Ukraine and your team. And also, what is the difference to working as a prosecutor or, you know, while documenting war crimes or investigating war crimes and usual crimes? Mm-hmm. Why you actually need something else to switch your mindset?
I mean, I think the easiest way to explain that is to ask a simple question, which is, with an ordinary crime, how many people are generally involved? With ordinary crimes, you're probably talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, the robbery, the murder, the sexual assault. Of course, with organized crime, you start to then talk about maybe tens and tens and tens and maybe sometimes hundreds. But with war crimes and crimes against humanity, you're almost always talking about the state and you're almost always talking about military organizations. So therefore, you're talking about thousands of people. So that's the first complication. If you're going to prosecute Putin, and I hope he is prosecuted, then you need to establish that what happened in Bucha was as a consequence of what he did. In ordinary crime, you would look for the Putin who sat down in the group with the perpetrators from Bucha and made a decision about what should exactly happen in Bucha. That's almost certainly not how the crimes in Bucha happened. Almost certainly not how Putin is responsible for the crimes in Bucha. Putin didn't order the rapes in Bucha or the executions in Irpin or the indiscriminate shelling in Mykolaiv. What he did was he almost certainly sat around a table with the likes of Shoigu, the FSB and so on, and he decided he's going to take over a country, Ukraine, and he's going to subjugate the population, he's going to control the population, and he's going to extinguish their identity because they don't really have an identity. Now, if you have that discussion, you're not ordering crimes, but the discussion and agreement you're coming to involve the inherently involved the commission of crimes, because how do you subjugate a population? How do you extinguish their identity? How do you deny them the freedom to move and do as they wish and they think without massive repression? And what is repression? Repression is the massive commission of crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity. So with Putin's plan, it's inherently criminal because it cannot be achieved without crime. But you then have to establish that he had that plan, what the policy was, and how the policy, thousands of kilometers, was implemented in such a way that it led to crimes in Ukrainian territory.
The Ukrainian state is now also advocating for the special tribunal for the crime of aggression for the reason that it can keep in request the accountability for exactly like those 20 people who took the decisions, like Putin, Shoigu, the Russian FSB leaders, and the others. I know you were changing also your opinion on that, how you can place that particular trial, because they don't look at the evidence on the ground. It's something else. Why it might be reasonable and why it's not exactly sufficient enough. How this should work together.
I mean, you're right. I mean, initially, February 2022, I heard international lawyers like Philippe Sands, who I respect hugely, talk about the Tribunal for the Crime of Aggression. For me, the red flag stood up because I thought, here we go, international lawyers advocating for international tribunals, which end up servicing international lawyers' agendas and salaries, and actually often deliver much less justice than promised. And I think, and I've worked in all the international tribunals in relation to modern day international criminal law, and I've seen it time and time again, and I've seen many promises, much money spent, but not just that. I've seen those tribunals sometimes, when looked at in the round, actually do as much damage as they do good. Why do I say that? Because if you create justice mechanisms which in the end undermine more holistic justice efforts, for example, the Special Court for Sierra Leone. At the time it was set up, there was discussions of a TRC, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which happened. There was talks of national trials of hundreds of mid-ranking commanders who were really brutal criminals. And there was talk of a Special Court for Sierra Leone. And what happened? Everybody became focused on the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It was the big, shiny international court. Lots of money got spent on it. No national trials were ever held of hundreds of perpetrators who were living freely in Sierra Leone, next to in the affected communities and next to victims. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a far more impressive truth-finding endeavor, was starved of funds because all the funds from international donors were going to the special court. So my alarm bells rang when I heard it. But then subsequently, I changed my mind about it because, as has been widely discussed, there is a gap. An international tribunal for the crime of aggression is needed to be able to prosecute Lavrov, the prime minister, and Putin. Without that, as we know, Ukraine cannot prosecute those three. National states can't prosecute those three because of their immunity. And so there is a gap. And that was the first thing. And then the second thing was, for me, was the nature of the crime of aggression. Many rightly say, well, hold on a second, what about the invasion of Iraq under the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction? And I sympathize with that, actually, because that was undoubtedly a crime of aggression by the Americans, by the UK, and others. But there is a distinction here. The crime of aggression in relation to Iraq was at least based on some misguided, perhaps, but I think well-intentioned idea that we could liberate the people in Iraq. It could be a force for democratic good. I mean, completely naive, completely silly, and as we've seen, completely damaging to the people of Iraq and to democracy in the region and to safety and security in the region. But this crime of aggression, Putin's crime of aggression, was not designed with good intentions. It was designed in order to subjugate millions of people. That, for me, is as bad a crime of aggression as you can find. And just to go to your point about whether that involves collecting evidence of what happened on the ground, in my view, it does, actually, because you have to, at some point, get Putin in the dock and prosecute him for that crime of aggression. And then work out how serious that crime of aggression is. How grave a crime was it? And this is a particularly grave crime of aggression because it is designed to, as I say, subjugate and brutalize millions of Ukrainians. So it's the most serious type of crime of aggression.
When I was at one of the panel with Philip Sent, a different idea which I became very concerned was when he made everybody in the audience cautious about the using the term of genocide. He has given an example then in one case in the war in the Balkans, there was the court was about the genocide, it was in Srebrenica, and in different case it was just the court about the crime against humanity, and the people were not satisfied because there is this hierarchy, you know, like the war crimes, crime against humanity, and the genocide. Of course, in public, in our culture, you know, there is this very loaded term of genocide, but still Ukraine is pursuing that. And I was probably for the first year very cautious, saying that like, oh, we don't want to create expectation, especially among the Ukrainian public, that there would be processes about the war crimes, there would be processes about crimes against humanity, but not genocide. And that would be the, let's say, positive decision for the survivors, for the victims, but they won't be satisfied because it's not that horrible, horrible crime of the genocide. At the same time, we started to observe particular patterns of the attempt of genocide. What are your views on that? Is it really better to stay away of, you know, using the term genocide and go there because it's so difficult and so loaded?
I understand Philippe's caution, and I think I increasingly share that caution. There's two things going on here. I mean, on the one hand, politically, it's very useful for Ukraine to talk about genocide, and it raises the temperature, and you want international support. And genocide, despite the fact that international lawyers say there is no hierarchy of crimes, we all know there actually is, because we all understand that genocide is more serious, or at least in the public mind, and also, frankly, in the courtroom. If you've got a genocide case, the judges take it more seriously. There's no doubt about it. So politically, there is some value in talking about genocide. Legally, I think it is becoming somewhat distracting, because my personal view is that there is a plausible, there's that word that we've heard from the ICJ this week in relation to Israel's behavior in Palestine. There is a plausible case of genocide here, I think. The starting point for arriving at that point of view is to look at the war crimes and the crimes against humanity. You can't get to that conclusion until you examine the war crimes and crimes against humanity, because it's only by looking at the pattern of crimes again and then looking at the link of individuals to that pattern of crimes that you begin to understand what their actual intent was. And that, as we know, is the critical part of genocide, that the perpetrator has to have a special intent to destroy in part or in whole a particular group. When you're talking about the prosecution here, they ought not to be looking just at genocide. They have to look at war crimes first. They have to look at crimes against humanity. And then after that, they may be able to come to a proper determination of genocide. The problem is if there is a rush to proving genocide, you'll miss what is absolutely essential, an essential evidentiary base to be able to get to that conclusion. And the route there for me in Ukraine is to look at the factual situation sought to be brought about by Russia, to occupy an area, to lock it down, to detain part of the population for torture, for deportation, for death, to brutalize the population outside of the detention centers, to force capitulation, to extinguish identity. To me, if you can establish all of those things, you come very close to a plausible, my view is over the line of a plausible case of genocide.
And how you would explain what identity is? A year ago with Anna Palbom, we just wrote the piece in particularly on how Russia was, the Russian soldiers in Kherson region and occupied territories were attacking the local villagers had, you know, the local leaders. Since then, we went on. There are more and more and more incidents that in Kherson region, if you were a local leader, probably a head of the village, most probably you've been either detained or tortured or abducted, or even some of them were killed. And there are a lot of people, they are not ethnic Ukrainians. They could be on different ethnic groups from the various religions.
So how would you, you know, explain Ukrainian identity in this regard?
This is about nationality and it's about political. It's about a national group and it's about a political group. It's about a group which, through its place of residence, through its political and social ties, identifies itself as Ukrainian. And then the political aspect is those Ukrainians who are targeted because they're considered to have pro-Ukrainian views. The way I think that the genocide comes into play here is, it's unfortunate actually, because I think what happened here is that the international community and to a certain extent, maybe even domestic audience has stopped looking at genocide, because I think what happened was many people in Ukraine did rush to the allegation that this was genocide as soon as Bucha was exposed. And I get that. It's certainly reminiscent of genocide when you uncover a crime scene like Bucha. So I understand that. But I think what happened was that led many Ukrainians to say, everything the Russians do is genocide. And I think international commentators then said, not according to the international definition of genocide. And what happened then was you had these two sides talking over each other rather than trying to work out whether there was a different manifestation of genocide. And that's my view. There's a different manifestation of genocide. Why? Because you're talking about a nation. You're not talking about an ethnicity like, say, in Srebrenica or in Rwanda, the classical genocides that we all think about in terms of modern-day genocide. We're talking about a nation. How do you physically destroy a nation, I think, is a different question to how do you physically destroy an ethnicity. One of the challenges is, and I think this is a general challenge for international criminal law in Ukraine, is the fact that if you look at the case law, if you look at the experience of modern-day international criminal law, nothing has been investigated and prosecuted which looks like what's happening in Ukraine. And if you look at the genocide case precedents at the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, which looked at Srebrenica, if you look at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which looked at the Rwandan genocide in 1994, they are not that similar. Rwanda was the mass killing of up to 800,000 Tutsis over, I think, three months with machetes. And Srebrenica was the mass killing of up to 8,000 Bosnian Muslims from a particular area in Bosnia. Again, committed very rapidly, a mass killing event. And as a consequence, of course, the jurisprudence, therefore, is number one, it's very underdeveloped. And number two, is extremely contradictory. And I'm very surprised when I hear international criminal lawyers putting a gloss on it as if it actually is good jurisprudence, that it makes complete sense, that there are no holes in it. Oh, no, this is not genocide, say some commentators. Why? Because, and this is leading genocide commentators, it's not genocide because there's not enough killing. That's easily shown to be a false premise, because if you look at the genocide acts, such as creating conditions calculated to destroy with intent, you don't need mass killing. If you look at the abduction of transfer of children, you don't need mass killing. You know, this idea that you need a mass killing event is not correct. If you look at what's happening in Ukraine, as I say, none of the modern day trial processes have looked at something like this. And I think we need to then ask ourselves the question, how do you physically destroy a national group? Well, first of all, what is a national? What is a nation? Ethnicity is easy. We can look at genes. We can look at how you look. We can say, okay, we went after you because you were a Tutsi and because you were ethnically part of this particular group. With a nation, how do you destroy it? Well, you go after those people who are pro the existence of that country. And you also, what you've tried to do is you just try to destroy the things which tie the people together, the shared experiences, the shared religion, the shared land, the shared cultural symbols. And you destroy the group by attacking those things, as well as physical destruction. And my view is that if you're attacking a nation, if you're trying to commit genocide of a nation, if you intend to commit genocide of a nation, or part of that nationality, you need a lot less physical destruction, but you need the physical destruction accompanied by the attempt to extinguish identity. And if you ask yourself the question, where would Ukraine be if Russia had been successful in its initial invasion in 5 years' time? What would it look like? Would Ukraine as a group exist? And if you look at it in 10 years, and this is where the abduction of children is really important to look at carefully, because a lot of that abduction is not just about stealing the children, but it's also about indoctrinating the children. In combination, you destroy the nation.
You know, we have the example. We have 10 years of the occupation of the Donetsk and Luhansk region and Crimea. Mm-hmm. And we can see how much Ukrainian that it remained, what is the life of the people. And we understand, of course, it was not still not that extreme as the, you know, occupation of the South. But, you know, it's not really theoretical in our case.
In other types of genocide, like Myanmar, which is alleged at the ICJ, that the Myanmar military drove out the Rohingya to Bangladesh, but their real intent was genocide, which may well be true when you look at the physical destruction that took place. But there is perhaps a plausible explanation of what you're trying to do, which sits at odds with the genocide, i.e. you're just trying to get rid of them. Whereas with Ukraine, actually, you're trying to destroy those you need to destroy in order to commit other crimes, which will then make sure that those other Ukrainians then deny their Ukrainian identity. The other crimes then, which you would ordinarily go, oh no, but this is about deportation. But in this case, the deportation is about the destruction. It's not deportation because you want to get rid of Ukrainians out of Ukrainian territory. It's deportation in order to further the general aim, which is to destroy Ukrainian nationality and the Ukrainian nation.
Still on Ukraine, when you read books, when you learn about other horrible historical incidents, you see that sometimes the crimes are very similar. You know, how the people are killed, tortured, and even like the deportation of the children. There were cases of the separation of the children in Argentina. And actually, mm-hmm. prior to that, the Franco regime did a lot on separating hundreds of thousands of children from their parents. So when you're looking at what's going on now in this war, with all your experience, what new do you see? And what are also like the new challenging types, crimes to prove and to deal?
When it comes to looking at sophisticated legal systems, it only existed for 30 years. You're talking about 1994. Very young. And if you look at a lot of the products coming out of international courts, they're not particularly impressive. And therefore, there is a long way to go in terms of defining the crimes, defining the way to investigate the crimes, defining the type of evidence you need to prove the crimes, and exploring methodologies to make sure that this type of criminal behavior is accurately adjudicated in a courtroom. So to your question, nobody's ever prosecuted ecocide, as far as I'm aware, certainly not an international court. Nuclear power never appeared in an international court. As I said before, genocide of a nation, as far as I'm aware, never in a national court and never in an international court. So there are a lot of firsts in Ukraine, and I think this is going to make life more difficult for Ukrainians. And I think it's also making life difficult for international criminal lawyers.
At the same time, when as long as I get out of Ukraine and speak especially to the journalists, and the further they are, let's say they have more questions and also less trust to the international courts, and especially people from the Balkans would say, like, don't be naive. It doesn't work. It lasts very long. And there would be people coming from Cambodia and saying, you know, a lot of money has been spent. However, we persecuted number one, brother two, brother three, and that's it. All those cynicism is there. Partially, Russia also played on this cynicism, because a lot of messages I heard was not about that, like, oh, there are no Russian war crimes in Ukraine, but, you know, the idea that, like, I would be never persecuted. And even if it'd be persecuted, there would be some scapegoats, low figures, but just forget about that, you know, give up. You're very critical because you know what are the things. Where you are now with everything we have discussed, where things went good, or at least we can be satisfied and learn, where were the mistakes?
First of all, sort of international courts are, in a sense, a sign of failure at the national level to bring about investigations and prosecutions of international crimes. On top of that, I would say international criminal tribunals have been disappointing, no doubt about it. I think They promised a lot. I mean, in the 1990s, they were promising to reconcile warring parties, bring about peace, bring about accountability, and the list goes on. And I think as a consequence of that, they promised too much and they delivered too little. I am cynical in that sense. On another level, though, I'm also hopeful, and I think Ukraine gives us some hope. Because I think, first of all, as you say, the national community rose up and decided that they had to do something about it. Civil society, as I said earlier, the prosecution became very committed to the cause, and I meet many civil society activists who are also committed to the cause. And that's the starting point. That has to be the starting point, as is well known. 90% or more of the crimes have to be investigated and prosecuted here.
But what is in between? In the Reckoning Project, our chief lawyer, Ibrahim Olabi, whom you know, really speaks about this idea of the justice as a process.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also see this gap. Just this weekend, I had to talk to a number of the survivors and our witnesses of crimes in 2 years ago. You know, so it's already time. And I needed to ask the question whether they had some interaction with the law enforcement. Somehow, some had this interaction, you know, half a year ago. They have no idea what's going on. And some of the people, they are already suspicious, or at least they're disillusioned. We also understand that sometimes in the rooms, even if there are trials in Ukraine, in absentia, there are almost no journalists. I do understand that it's not like there was a crime and there would be in 3 years the verdict. There should be something going on in between. What that should be?
What is success? I think we need to redefine that with Ukraine. I think we need to redefine that with lots of criminal processes in relation to international crimes. I don't see success limited to trials. I think success is to document and investigate and point the finger powerfully at those responsible.
What does it mean? Point the finger powerfully.
Build cases and advocate for their surrender and trial. And let's face it, with Ukraine, there's not going to be thousands of trials in the foreseeable future. There's not going to be hundreds of trials in the foreseeable future. We'll be lucky if there's dozens of trials in the foreseeable future. We can't get hold of the suspects. Building the cases is slow and difficult. What's your alternative judge of success? To my mind, is to take a more sort of wider perspective. And I recognize it's easy for me to say I'm not a direct victim. But we know Russia denies its criminal behavior. We know that it manages to garnish support from many different countries for their denials. But we also know that, as Ibrahim says, that justice is a process and it takes a very long time. What we want is, in 20 years' time, when those Russian suspects become available or make a mistake and become detained, we've got the cases ready for them. What we need for when international organizations decide to, let's get rid of the sanctions and invite Russia back into the mainstream, that we go, no. Look, we have cases against Putin, we have cases against Shoigu, we have cases against all these people, and international law demands accountability. That, to me, is pointing the finger powerfully.
When I had a chance to talk to the general prosecutor, and he had a chance also to talk to our survivors, there was this very interesting interaction when he also explained that there is a challenge for Ukraine to change the system upside down, because in post-Soviet system, for the prosecutors, the main goal is to identify the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. You didn't really care very much about the victims. And now you are here, have the situation when you have hundreds, thousands of survivors and victims, and just a few possible perpetrators. And the only thing you can work with is those survivors. And there are some tiny, but I think very symbolically important changes, like, for instance, changing the term interrogation into the witness interview, you know, which makes this process more human, because interrogation in Ukraine, really, you know, you are afraid if somebody approached to interrogate you. But then I started to think, like, but are there any countries where there is, you really have this victim-centered approach? Because we can complain about post-Soviet system, but are there any
persecutors or, you know, systems in which, you know, the persecutors care about victims. I can't recall, or maybe they are.
No, I think you make a really good point. And I think it goes beyond the idea of supporting victims. And it goes to a question which much of international criminal law does not like to ask, which is, what do you want? What does accountability mean to you? And I think if you ask that question in many countries, what you don't get is, number one, we want trials, we want retribution, we want the person in prison. If you go to Sierra Leone and you ask many of the victims, and I was there for a very long time, 6 years, and you ask the general population what they wanted in relation to the civil war, which killed many villagers and many innocent people and burnt their houses down, what did they want? They wanted a new house. They wanted a community which looked after them before they wanted a trial. Trials were down the priority list. But of course, international criminal law does not want to ask that question because it's sort of doing itself out of business. And in some places, of course, people do want retribution. I mean, and they do want trials and they do want people locked up. And that is perfectly understandable and perfectly legitimate. I think the important thing is that we need to, and I think this needs to happen in Ukraine, is there needs to be an honest conversation, which starts with this. You are not going to get all these suspects in the foreseeable future. I see this as a process which, a long time after I'm retired, I hope that they're still going after, Ukraine is still going after Russian suspects. And I think that's highly likely, as it's still happening in the Balkans, as it's still happening in Rwanda, and so on. The starting point for that discussion is, you're not going to get that. What would you like as alternatives? And I think that discussion about, and we call it transitional justice. I'm not keen on that term because it's become something and nothing. What is a victim-centered approach? What do you want as a victim? You may not get it, but let's have a discussion about it and see how we can engineer the criminal justice system to provide better outcomes for you.
Wayne, this is more or less the first like huge case where you are in the position of being on the side of the survivors and victims. Your big career stories are being a defense lawyer for perpetrators in Sierra Leone, in Cambodia. How would you explain what were you exactly doing, why you were doing this?
You know, now I think my CV is sort of filled with representing victims and working in Ukraine. But like you say, I mean, the first part of my career was as a defense lawyer. And actually, I started off as a defense lawyer in the UK, as a barrister there. And actually, I still see that as some of the most valuable human rights work I did, because I was defending people from the lowest socioeconomic group, a lot of black people who were committing crimes because they were drug addicts, because they'd been abused as kids, because they lived in terrible circumstances and conditions, and that poverty and deprivation leads to crime. And so I did a lot of defending of those types of individuals, and I still think it's some of the most valuable human rights work I did. It then made a lot of sense in 1999 when I began to work internationally to continue being a defense lawyer. And it also made a lot of sense because at that point, defense rights in the international criminal world were really, really poor, to the point that you couldn't even use the same facilities as the prosecution and the court, to the extent that you could have no real cross-examination, no equality of arms between the prosecution and defense. It was almost impossible to get acquitted in the first 10 or 15 years. You were responsible because of your title, not because of what you did. So that was also very valuable work, I think, that I did in the human rights sphere. And I still think there's problems with defense and accused rights. Ask the Ukrainian population, and this is true of almost all populations, ask them, is that person responsible? And they go, for sure they're responsible. Why? Well, because they're the general. And often that's true, but it may also not be true. And I think it's because of my background, because I believe in the rights of the individual and human rights, I think are important even more so when it's not a popular cause. So defending individuals charged with war crimes, crimes against humanity, is not a popular cause. And that's when they're most at risk, in my view.
We never really touch it. In these processes in Rwanda, in Sierra Leone and Cambodia, with your previous experience as a defense lawyer, so where was the problem? How you managed to defend those perpetrators? Were they the wrong targets? Were they not responsible? Because it also something we can understand in our trials that probably the wrong guys would be accused, or maybe they would be accused for different types of crimes. So what is your major experience from that we can learn as well?
Well, I think two lessons to learn. One is that it's not as easy as people think to establish evidential links between what the top people do and the crimes on the ground. In an ideal world, you'd be in the offices where they discuss their criminal policies, and then you'd have them easily. But absent that, you have to build up slowly through evidence the picture that they created a policy and they became very aware that it was leading to crimes on the ground, and yet they continue to pursue that policy. If you break that down, you begin to see how much evidence you need to establish each element of that. So it takes a long time, and you have to be patient, and you have to presume innocent. If you presume guilt, you'll miss something. That's critical. If you presume that they're already guilty, you won't get the evidence you need.
In terms of the people you were defending, what was like your defense line major?
To generalize, it was, this goes to my second point, which is this, that not every single person within the upper military and political leadership are responsible. That seems counterintuitive, but it's often true that people end up there with very little power and can be opposing the criminal policy, but they don't have the power to stop it, and they don't have the room to remove themselves from that hierarchy. That goes to this presumption of guilt. The first client I defended was a mayor from Rwanda who was found not guilty. The prosecution said, look, he was there during the Rwanda genocide. He was a mayor, therefore he's responsible. We had a Swedish nun, this is not a joke, we had a Swedish nun who said on the days when the Hutu extremists came to Tutsis, this man, Baglashima, was there trying to defend the Tutsis. So he had a position, he was there, but he was doing his best within that position to stop the crimes. That's what you need to look for. And I think I've had a couple of clients, your general defense is all these crimes happened, but it's not me. I was not linked to those crimes. My authority didn't extend to that military activity. My activity was much more niche. That's usually your defense. And sometimes it's true.
Would you in this time, like at all things that you in different life would consider defending somebody like Shoigu, like Lavrov, like Putin?
If 10 years ago, I would, before I came to Ukraine and before I got to know Ukrainians, before I had a Ukrainian wife, I would for sure have thought about it because I think it's an honorable profession. I think you can't have a decent, robust legal system, and you can't have respect human rights if you're not prepared to give the worst of the worst a robust defense. I mean, as soon as you get into the world of just having prosecutions without good defenses, you're talking about persecutions. And there is a reason why fair trials are part of Common Article 3 to the Geneva Conventions, because a right to a fair trial is as fundamental as all the other rights within the Geneva Conventions. So, and of course that has to be right, that the state or an international mechanism can take away your freedom without giving you a trial, can just deprive you of your freedom. Why? Because you happen to be in the military, because you happen to be a politician at a time when crimes were occurring. To me, that's the opposite of what human rights are about. And I stand by that.
But you said if it were 10 years ago, but mm-hmm. What about now?
No, there's no chance. I mean, there's no chance I would ever defend any of those characters. Well, number one, I'm conflicted out because I work effectively for the prosecution here. Number two, I've changed. I think, my focus is to use whatever talents I have to try to obtain some justice for victims. And I think for me, that's the bigger urgency, the bigger emergency is to try to, in this world of increasing chaos, increasing violence, I think I would much rather be focused on trying to obtain a little bit of justice for victims than representing people who at least previously had a huge amount of power. And thirdly, I don't think my wife would ever speak to me again if I was to even think about prosecuting, defending any of those characters.
I should say we know it's all the problem. Today we do have the situation when a lot of defense lawyers refuse to be defendant of the Russian soldiers. Even there, for instance, you know, there is a trial in absentia, but that hinders the prosecution because neither judges don't want to participate nor defend lawyers. So for prosecutors, it's a problem. Ukraine, you know, facing this issue that, of course, in Ukraine, it would be hard to explain why you defend a Russian soldier. I would say final, then you explained, you know, your relation to Ukraine on the human level, you know, like not on the level, forget that you're a lawyer.
Well, I mean, just on a human level to the last question as well about, I think that's what would prevent me also from defending is that on a human level, I am much too close to Ukrainian life, to Ukrainian friends, to Ukrainian culture, to Ukrainian hopes and dreams to be able to defend a Russian, you know, without all of that getting in the way. So that's one thing. I mean, in terms of Ukraine, I think on a personal level, you know, I've lived in many different countries, and I think I came to Ukraine when I was 45, and I was thinking that perhaps I should try to find a place to buy a house and live more normally, build some stability in my life. And at the time, I was thinking about Paris, where I was living, and I was thinking about Serbia, where I've been traveling to for many years. And I was thinking about Holland, where the center of international criminal law. I was in no way thinking about Ukraine. And then I came here. Kiev is a wonderful city. I met my now wife, Svetlana Zalichchuk. I'm happy that my life ended up in Ukraine. I'm happy that it ended up in Kiev. I feel terribly terrible about the fact that the Ukraine, who I think deserves better, is being attacked so mercilessly by such violence from the Russian state and people, it seems. And I would like to stay here as much as possible and play my part in helping Ukraine to resist this monstrosity. That's how I see my legal role is. I'm not a frontline man, but I think everybody who's here, including those like me who have adopted Ukraine as their country, have an obligation to do what they can to help it defend itself. That's what I hope I'm doing.
Thank you, and wish you and all us luck and have enough, you know, force to have the force with us to
definitely
to do that.
Thank you. Absolutely.